Von Clappen and Chu and I've been talking. I need to find Michael. And she rushed out of the tent, into the night air, and stopped. She heard Hugo Algernon come out behind her. Yeah, I was going to tell you about that next. The island was nearly empty. The campfires were out. The encampments gone. The few soldiers who were still there were busy helping the refugee families load onto ships. And Kate realized that she'd been aware the whole time she'd been talking to Hugo Algernon of how quiet it had been outside the tent. What happened? Where is everyone? We're moving the families, just in case that scout ship reported our location to the enemy. But the army's gone to Loris, left just before sunset.
But they're outnumbered. It's suicide. Everyone said so.
Well, now, Hugo Algernon scratched his beard. You've been unconscious a while. That attack sort of pulled everyone together, made those nitwits remember who the real enemy was, and then King Robbie had this idea. For a dwarf, he's not completely thick. He appointed a new commander, one that was acceptable to all three races. It's mostly a ceremonial position, of course, but soon as word got out, new recruits started pouring in from around the world. Von Clappen and Chu and I must have had a dozen portals going non-stop. From noon to sunset, the army doubled, then tripled in size. They've got a chance. Not a big one, but a chance. Kate turned to face him. Who's the new commander? Hugo Algernon grinned and actually looked sheepish. Well, imagine there was a human who was also an honorary dwarf, and who just so happened to be the boyfriend of an elf princess. If you can, try to see the humor in this. Michael stood on the deck of the ship. There was no moon, which was a good thing, but the stars were clustered thickly overhead. The air was warm and heavy with salt. He was wearing the chain mail tunic King Robbie had given him, which was remarkably light and supple, and he also had on dwarfish battle leathers, which were thicker and stiffer than he would have liked. A sword and a knife, both given to him by King Robbie, were strapped to his waist. He stared out at the fleet, his fleet, spread across the dark water. Michael knew it was silly to think of any of it, the ships, the soldiers, as his, that he was commander in name only, but he couldn't help himself. As all the ships were sailing at the same speed, they hardly seemed to be moving, but Michael could hear the sluicing of water across the hulls, the snapping of ropes, the creak and whine of wood. All afternoon, as Kate had lain unconscious in their tent, watched over alternately by him or Hugo Algernon, or Magda von Clappen, or Wilhelmina, soldiers had arrived to swell their ranks. The first to arrive had been the fighters from Gabriel's village, 2 dozen stern-faced, dark-haired men whose presence in the camp had filled Michael with confidence. Then there were dwarves from Lapland, who came with icicles hanging from their beards, and axes as long as they were tall. River elves from Thailand, who spoke a language that even the other elves couldn't understand. More elves from the mountains of Morocco, who dressed in long, colourful robes. Human fighters from the Badlands. So many, Michael thought, but would it be enough? Magda von Clappen stood on the foredeck conversing with Master Chu. She had already had the same conversation with Michael that Hugo Algernon had had with Kate.
But we still have to deal with the Dire Magnus, Michael had said, and we still have to rescue Emma.
Yes, if he gains control of the Reckoning, we are all dead anyway.
And if we beat him, then just me and my sisters have to die.
We are working on that,
the witch had said.
Even now, Michael wondered at his own calmness. It was as if he'd split himself in two. There was Michael Wibberley, the head of the army, who knew that the only way of keeping the world safe was to defeat the Dire Magnus. Then there was Michael Wibberley, the 13-year-old boy who'd do anything to save his sisters and who felt death and disaster breathing down their necks. His hand rested on the shape of the chronicle in his bag, and he wondered how much of the magic was in him. How long did they have? With effort, he pulled his mind back to the present. He glanced up to the outline of Captain Anton in the crow's nest, the elf peering through the darkness for the first sight of Loris. All about Michael, men and dwarves were quietly checking their kits. He noted how, besides the usual weapons and equipment, they had all been outfitted with an odd-looking metal apparatus fashioned by dwarf blacksmiths on the island. Michael had examined one of the objects, but could not figure out what it was or what it was intended to do. He'd asked King Robbie, who'd only smiled and said, "Let it be a surprise, lad, for you and for the enemy." Then he added, "Besides, it may not even work."
"Wabbit."
Wilhelmina stepped toward him. She was wearing a dress the color of midnight and had a dagger at her waist attached to a silver belt. Her hair, which shone faintly in the darkness, was in two thick braids down her back.
"What troubles you? Are you worried about Catherine? She will recover." "No, I know. Then what is it?"
Michael thought of telling her what Magda von Klappen had told him about what the books were doing to the world, about his and his sister's deaths being the only way anyone knew of that would fix the damage. Did she already know? No, he decided. She would have said something, or written a poem about it.
"Nothing. I mean, we've got a plan. We're all going to do our best, and..."
Michael felt her hand, cool and soft, take his. He stopped rambling and looked into her eyes. As always happened, he felt pulled into a private magical space that belonged solely to the two of them. He spoke so only she could hear.
"I know this is necessary, that if we're not at the portal when Emma comes through, the Dire Magnus will get the reckoning, and life as we know it will end. But even with all these new soldiers, we could still fail, and..."
He paused, feeling embarrassed by the chain mail and sword. He wished he was wearing his own clothes.
"It'll be my fault, our fault, mine and my sister's, because everyone here's thinking we can defeat the Dire Magnus. I'm scared we're just going to get them all killed."
The elf princess put her finger under his chin and lifted his face till his eyes met hers again.
"This fight found us. What you and your sisters have done is to give them hope. That is magic in itself."
"But what if we lose?"
"Then we lose. There are things worth dying for. Friendship, loyalty, love. And if in fighting for those this is the last stand of the elves, then so be it."
Michael found himself struggling to hold back tears.
"Thank you."
She kissed his cheek.
"Now, come see what I've brought you."
She led him down the deck to where a large object was covered with black cloth. She drew the fabric away, and at first Michael could make no sense of what he was seeing. It was made of leather, but he found it to be a leather of such softness and suppleness that he thought he was touching silk. Then he realized.
"It's a saddle. Indeed.
But we don't have any horses."
"Oh, it's for something much larger than a horse." "You don't mean..." "There is no one else whom I trust to protect my rabbit. We will fight this fight together."
She kissed him again. Not his cheek this time, and Michael felt a warmth spreading through his body and sensed he was on the verge of saying something extremely embarrassing when a sound as soft as the footfall of a cat made them turn. Captain Anton had leapt down to the deck.
He said, "Something is coming!"
Carrying the lantern from her tent, Kate made her way to the beach where she'd killed the imp. The island was emptying out, the families from Loris almost completely loaded onto the boats. Hugo Algernon had already disappeared, saying he had a matter to see to.
No doubt a fool's errand, but as Pym is not here to do it, I suppose I have to.
He told her to get on one of the boats carrying the refugees, and she'd promised she would. But she had something to do first. She discovered when she'd woken that her jacket had been taken from her. Apparently, it had been covered in imp blood and burned. That was fine, but her mother's locket was also missing. Kate surmised that the chain must have been broken when the imp had fallen on her, so now she had gone back to the beach alone in the dark to find it. The beach was empty, and the tide had come in a long way. Kate searched carefully, holding the lantern down low, and she found the locket along the water's edge, nestled among the dark stones. The chain had indeed been broken, but both locket and chain were still there, and Kate lifted them with trembling fingers. She had lost the locket once before, in New York, and Rafe had recovered it and the chain and returned them to her. She slid the locket and chain into her pocket. She said,
"You're there, aren't you?"
"Yes." She turned. Rafe stood just behind her. The lantern at her side lit only part of his face. His eyes remained in darkness. She tried to ignore the pounding of her heart.
"You think Michael and the others have a chance?"
He shrugged.
"I guess we'll see."
"I had that dream again."
"What dream?"
"When I was in the church in New York. You were there."
"Did I say anything?"
"No."
"Sometimes a dream is just a dream."
Kate found herself wishing she'd been able to talk to Michael before he'd left with the army. She would have finally told him about Rafe appearing to her. She would have apologized for keeping it secret and would have asked him to forgive her. She said, "Can we stop pretending?" For a moment, nothing happened. Then he smiled.
"When did you figure it out?"
And that smile, the confirmation it held, was like a hammer blow. She swallowed and managed to speak.
"Just today, I think. I've known for a while, but I didn't want to."
She dropped her gaze to the stones at her feet. She couldn't look at him, for to look at him was to see Rafe, and he wasn't Rafe. Rafe was dead. He had died 100 years ago, the night he had sacrificed himself so that she could live. The thing next to her was the monster that had killed him. That was what she had to remember.
"Why did you do it? Just to torture me?"
He actually managed to sound hurt.
"Of course not.
So from the beginning, that first time in the garden, that was..."
"It was me,
yes."
"But why? Why appear to me at all? Why trick me?"
It was taking all of Kate's will and strength to hold herself together.
"Because I needed you at the fortress. You and your brother."
"I already had Emma. And if I'd succeeded in bonding her to the Reckoning, I could have fulfilled the prophecy and my quest then and there."
"But you didn't. Michael pulled her spirit back, and Dr. Pym, he..."
"Sacrificed himself. It just made things more difficult. And anyway, I'd planned for the chance my first attempt might fail."
"What do you mean?"
She glanced up at him and had to bite her lip to keep from crying out. She felt as if she was being ripped in two. She wanted to run to him, hold him, and at the same time she wanted to kill him. Why did he have to look like Rafe? Why couldn't he look like the murderer he was?
"It's difficult, I know."
He sounded almost sympathetic.
"You'll get used to it."
She turned away, her arms tight across her chest, staring across the black water.
"To answer your question, I hadn't waited thousands of years to risk everything on a single chance. I knew there was a possibility you three might escape, and I knew if you did, it would be by using the Atlas. So I took precautions.
When I came to you in the garden on Loris, I placed the image of the giant's land in your mind."
I made it so it would be the first thing the Atlas seized on when you tried to escape. From there, I hardly had to do anything. The three of you found the giant city and the Countess all by yourself. You brought her back to life, as I knew you would, and discovered where the book was hidden. How long have you known where it was? 1,000 years or so. You couldn't have planned it all. It really wasn't that hard. And now we're almost done. Then he said, "Come to me." "No." She felt him step closer, so close he could whisper in her ear. "You believed I was Rafe because you wanted to believe. I am still him, but so much more. I told your sister the only fight you'll never win is the one against your own nature. I stopped fighting that battle long ago. I'm who I was always meant to be. A new world is about to be born, Kate. I want you there with me." Kate could feel the magic of the Atlas stirring within her. She could call it up, command it to take her somewhere, anywhere. So what if she wasn't able to control it like she used to? So what if it hurt her? She would be far away from him. But she couldn't bring herself to do it. "You're weak," she told herself. "You're weak and an idiot, and you betrayed the two people you love most in the world." "Kate," she shook her head, "then I'm sorry about this." She was still staring across the water when she heard the roaring and then the screams. She didn't look at him, she just dropped the lantern and ran. In no time she was back on top of the cliff and could see down to the harbour and beyond to where the families from Loris were escaping. A jagged line of boats stretched across the water. A pair of water spouts, giant, whirling funnels of wind and water, had sprung up and were tearing toward the line of boats. Kate saw the tip of the first funnel cleave its way through a boat carrying more than 30 people. She heard wood splinter and break. She heard screaming. "Stop it! Stop it!" "It's your choice, Kate." He was standing beside her. "Just say the words." Kate saw the second waterspout heading toward a boat carrying dozens of families. Despite the distance and the darkness, she could see the children aboard. She could hear their terrified voices. "Yes, fine, whatever you want." Instantly the winds died, and the cyclone sank into the water. Kate stared at the bay, at the other ships moving to rescue those who had been thrown from their boats. The water now littered with broken bits of wood and the luggage of the refugees, with people. "But how am I supposed to get to you? I can't control the Atlas. It—" He made a calming noise. "It's okay. I can help." She felt the tingle as he reached up to touch her temple, just as he had in the garden days before. He said, "It's almost over. Now, come to me."
Chapter 23 Fog and Ice. It was fog. That was what the elf captain had seen, a grey mass in the distance where the island of Loris should have been, and moving toward them at a completely unnatural speed. Before long, Michael was able to see it himself as the stars along the horizon began to disappear. At King Robbie's order, the soldiers started to prepare themselves while a dwarf with a shielded lantern flashed a complicated staccato to the other ships.
"He's trying to cut us off from each other," the Dwarf King explained.
"What can we do about it?" Michael asked.
"Master Chu?"
"Already working on it,"
the wizard said. That should have been reassuring, but as far as Michael could see, Master Chu wasn't doing anything but standing there and smiling and fiddling with his beard. Soon the first tendrils were reaching over the prow of the ship, long grey snakes of cold, damp air. It was almost like sailing into a dream. Michael watched the other ships vanish one by one as their keel continued cutting steadily through the water, propelled by the enchanted wind that Magda von Klappen and Master Chu had summoned. Now and then there was the muffled sound of a bell or a shout, otherwise silence. Michael felt Wilhelmina take his hand. On they went, and time too seemed to be lost in the mist. Then the wrinkled dwarf helmsman said,
"We must be no more than 1,000 yards from Loris. I'd bet my beard."
King Robbie muttered something, a curse perhaps, then,
"Master Chu, almost there."
To Michael, Master Chu still appeared to be doing nothing but smiling and touching his beard, and he was about to ask why didn't they stop until they got rid of the fog, when Captain Anton stepped in front of Michael and the elf princess, an arrow notched on his bowstring.
"What is it?"
King Robbie said, and the words were scarcely out when the elf captain loosed an arrow up into the mist, another instantly on his string, and a swarm of black shapes swept howling down out of the fog, and King Robbie cried, "Cover!" and threw Michael to the deck. Michael's breath was knocked out of him, but he could still see the creatures raking across the ship, tearing at dwarves and men with their claws and disappearing upward into the fog.
"Archers!"
King Robbie roared, his axe gripped in his right hand.
"Watch the captain! Follow his lead!"
There was movement everywhere now. Shields were up, swords and spears at the ready. Men and dwarves scoured the mist for any sign of attack.
"There!"
The elf captain shot his arrow into the fog. Michael heard a distinct, muted thud, and instantly a whispering hail of arrows followed it upward as the creatures swooped down. Three of the creatures fell clumsily onto the deck. More splashed into the water, wounded or dead. But others made it through the rain of arrows, and all around them dwarves and men were struck down or knocked into the sea. One of the creatures was flopping about on the deck, just in front of Michael, an arrow sticking from its chest. The thing was the size of a vulture, with bat-like wings, claws as long as Michael's hands, a body that was all leathery skin and bone. King Robbie swung his axe, and the creature's head leapt from its body. The dwarf king heaved the carcass over the side.
"Princess," King Robbie said, "any help, I'd appreciate it."
Wilhelmina took the golden bracelet from her pocket and looked at Michael.
"Get the saddle."
Then she turned and dove over the side, disappearing into the fog-covered water. Michael ran to the saddle and swung it onto his shoulder. It weighed almost nothing. King Robbie bellowed,
"They're coming round again!"
But just as Michael looked up to see the dark shapes rushing toward them, there was an explosion of gold from the water, a great rippling jet of flame, and Michael saw four of the demon birds fall, burning into the sea, as the dragon seized another and literally ripped it apart.
"Ha!" King Robbie shouted. "That's the way!"
The dragon hovered next to the ship, and Michael felt, as he always did in the dragon's presence, a thrilling wildness in his breast, a sense of being desperately, dangerously alive.
"Are you ready, Wabbit?"
"Yes, how do I—"
"The saddle knows what to do. Throw it!"
Michael obeyed, and watched as the saddle settled perfectly on the dragon's back, the straps fastening themselves underneath her torso.
"You'll have to leap. I cannot hold to the ship without swamping it."
Michael didn't hesitate, but climbed immediately to the railing. They were still cutting through the water, and Wilhelmina was flying to keep pace, the beating of her wings taking her up and down, up and down.
"Whoa there!" King Robbie said, catching sight of Michael. "What are you?"
Michael jumped, landing askew in the saddle, his arms grasping uselessly at the scales of the dragon's neck, and for one terrifying moment he thought he might tumble into the sea. But then the saddle seemed to grab hold of him and pull him into place, the straps lashing themselves around his legs.
"Never fear, Wabbit. Once on my back, you will not fall."
Then Michael heard Master Chu clap his hands once, twice. A great wind swept over the sea, almost pushing the ship onto its side. The fog cleared. Silence fell. The island of Loris was not 600 yards distant, the city and harbor lit by hundreds of fires. But between themselves and the island was a solid mass of ships, at least twice as many as the attackers, and each one larger and taller than Michael's ships, and bristling with imps and screeches and trolls, and who knew what else. The sky above was thick with the demonic birds. Their enemy had been waiting for them. Then, as if on cue, all the screeches on all the ships let out a single shattering cry.
"Open your eyes!"
Kate felt fingers at her temples, and it was not the tingle of ghostly fingers, but the pressure of real ones, and she looked up into a pair of green eyes. He was leaning over her. She was lying on the floor, a pillow under her head.
"How do you feel?" "Fine."
He moved back as she sat up. She was in the Rose Citadel, she knew that, though she had never been in this room before. It had a stone floor, a long wooden table, paintings and maps on the walls. There were candles about the room, more hanging from a pair of iron chandeliers, and there were three curtained archways that gave out to a wide balcony, past which she could see the glow of fires. And she could smell smoke and burning metal and tar. There was the shrieking of Moram Khadi, but it sounded far away. The patched pants and shirt and jacket that he'd worn when he'd appeared to her, Rafe's clothes, were gone, and he was dressed in a long black robe. His dark hair, his slightly crooked nose, his eyes, all that was the same. She tried not to look at him and forced herself to stand.
"Has anyone told you what the books are doing?"
"Yes, they're tearing apart the world, and the only way to stop it is for me and Michael and Emma to die." "Then lucky for you. I'm the one person who knows how to save you." She looked at him now, unable not to.
"I'm not lying," he said. "Why would I? I've already got you here."
"Tell me how," he smiled.
"Patience."
Frustrated, Kate turned away, and her eyes fell on a sword that was lying on the table. It was 3 feet long and sheathed in a beaten leather scabbard, and had a bone handle. She knew she had seen it somewhere before. He reached over and picked it up.
"This belonged to your friend Gabriel. He used it to kill Rourke, which was a blow, I'll confess. Rourke was a faithful servant. Perhaps, after I've got the chronicle, I'll bring him back."
"Where's Gabriel now?"
"Dead."
He threw the sword carelessly onto the table. Kate sensed he was telling the truth about Gabriel and struggled not to show how much it upset her.
"Come here."
He took her hand and started to draw her toward the balcony.
"Emma, not yet. I'll know when she's close. I want to show you something."
Holding his hand caused a shiver to run through Kate's entire body, the same as it had on a street in New York 100 years ago, and though she hated herself for it, she did not try to pull away.
"But this isn't him," she told herself. "This isn't Rafe."
He led her to the edge of the balcony, to where they could look out over the city to the harbor and the sea beyond. The Loris that Kate had first come to days before had been calm, peaceful, beautiful. Terraced houses and narrow stone streets, groves of olive and lemon trees, and even at night, the white stone that the city was built from seemed to make everything glow. What she saw now was a hellish version of that city. The houses torn down, olive and lemon groves burned, the white stone scorched with smoke. The city swarmed with imps and screeches and other creatures that Kate couldn't identify, and she could see huge engines of war gathered behind the walls, great boiling vats of tar and oil. And the noise rising up, the shrieking and shouting, the steady and terrible beat of drums was both deafening and jarring, and it battered at the remnants of her courage. But that wasn't the worst. Just past the arms of the harbor, she saw the two fleets, the one massive, the one so much smaller, and the smaller she knew contained Michael and King Robbie and all their friends. There was no way they could win. They were doomed.
Please, no, not this time. But it's up to them. If they surrender, I won't harm them. It's their choice.
But they'll never surrender. King Robbie, the others, you know they won't.
And he said, then they'll die. For the first few minutes, though Michael told himself the elfish saddle would keep him firmly on the dragon's back and he was in no danger of falling off, he found he could do nothing but hold on and try not to vomit as Wilhelmina spun and flipped and dove through the air. It was still hours till dawn, but Michael could see, thanks to the showers of flaming arrows, the fires aboard the ships, and the glow from the distant lights of Loris. He could see how the two fleets had moved in among each other, the enemy throwing out chains and hooks to grapple onto King Robbie's ships, pulling in close so that their imps and screeches could swarm over the sides. And even with the wind rushing past, he could hear the cries of the Morumkadi, the horns and drumbeats, the swoosh of arrows, the thud of spears striking wood. None of it escaped him. And there was something else, apart from the battle raging on the water, that engaged Michael's attention. He'd always, at least since he'd known who the dragon was, been able to detect Wilhelmina in her. Now, as she ruthlessly tore through and burned and ripped apart the flying creatures of the enemy, she seemed somehow more dragon and less elf princess than ever before. Fortunately, this new viciousness meant that soon enough the sky was clear. But Michael didn't celebrate, for, looking down, he could see that their side was still greatly outnumbered.
"Go back to the ship!" Michael shouted. "We need to talk to King Robbie!"
To his distress, Wilhelmina flipped backward and dove straight down. They found the Dwarf King's ship trapped by a much larger ship, and in the process of being boarded, with imps and screeches storming across planks, and King Robbie's soldiers struggling to fight them off.
"We have to help them!" Michael cried.
The dragon growled,
"How long can you hold your breath?"
"What?"
And Michael just had time to grab hold of his glasses and take a deep gulp of air as the dragon plunged into the water beside the enemy ship. All around them was darkness, and the water was very cold, but Michael could feel the dragon wiggling like a great fish, her tail whipping behind them. Then she grasped onto something, and a moment later there was an explosion of light. By the time he dared to look, he saw the dragon unleashing a concentrated stream of fire into the wooden bottom of the ship. Michael could feel the water heating up around him. Then the fire stopped, and the dragon began ripping out the charred planks with her claws, creating a bigger and bigger hole in the bottom of the ship. And Michael pounded against the dragon's back to tell her he had run out of breath, but she kept ripping out planks, making the hole ever bigger. And just as Michael reached the point where he truly knew he couldn't take any more, the dragon let go, thrusting up to the surface. The air was the sweetest thing Michael had ever tasted.
"Forgive me, Wabbit. I had to make sure the hole was large enough."
"What was it?"
"Look."
And Michael put his dripping glasses on in time to see the enormous ship disappearing below the surface of the sea. The imps and screeches jumping into the water where they were being picked off by Robbie McClower's archers. Okay, he thought, one down, 50 to go. Then the dragon dove toward the Dwarf King's ship. Robbie McClower was at the rail to meet them.
"That was well done, Princess. We're in your debt again."
"But how are you going to get past their ships?"
Michael shouted, looking out at the still massive fleet that stood between them and the harbour. The Dwarf King smiled, and Michael could see that in his own way he was loving this.
"We just had to get close enough to shore. Remember the surprise?"
He raised his shield, and a crossbow bolt thudded into it.
"The fact is, dwarves fight better with something solid under their feet."
Then he turned to where Magda von Klappen stood with Master Chu, and shouted,
"You ready?"
"We are," Magda von Klappen snapped, "though this is complex, and..."
"Right! Get a move on!"
And Michael saw the Dwarf King signal a trumpeter, and four short blasts sounded through the din. There followed more shouts and bursts of activity on all their ships, and Michael could see the human and dwarfish soldiers doing something to their boots.
"What's going on?"
Michael asked. "What's happening?" For already he felt the temperature dropping sharply, and the dragon said,
"Look at the water."
Michael glanced down and saw ice forming across the surface of the sea, spreading at an incredible speed as the black water turned white and hard, and all the ships were held fast. Then wooden ramps and iron poles shot down out of their ships, biting into the ice so that the ships were held upright. And Michael saw dwarves and men running down the ramps, and he waited for them to hit the ice and slip, but they didn't. And he saw that each one had affixed a kind of sharp-toothed metal bracket to the bottoms of their feet. And Michael recalled all the dwarfish smiths on the island so hard at work, and the soldiers' feet gripped the ice. And this was happening all over, their boats held in place while their armies poured down onto the ice, though, he noticed, the elves did not wear the crampons. At first, he thought because they probably didn't like how they looked, but then he saw that they didn't need them. They ran lightly and surely across the ice, and the enemy's ships had no such luck. They were sprawled on their sides, many of the imps and screechers trapped inside, and the ones who could scramble out were slipping and falling, and no match for the sure-footed dwarves and elves and humans. In a moment, the tide of the battle had turned. There was another blast from the horns, and Michael heard the Dwarf King's voice booming,
"To the wall! To the wall!"
"Shall we help them?"
the dragon purred.
"Yes," Michael said, and he felt a new strength rising inside him.
The dragon tore over the now chaotic enemy, scattering them further, while King Robbie and the army raced into the rocky arms of the harbor. Before them, the white walls of Loris rose up, and Michael could see the ramparts bristling with figures. And as Michael's army charged toward shore, arrows rained down from above. Wilhelmina swerved upward, and Michael could hear the steel tips clattering off her mailed stomach. The dragon checked her climb, just out of bowshot, and Michael, his heart hammering, looked down and saw the army, his army, gathering on the strip of beach before the walls of the city. And he knew that King Robbie would be forming them into units, but the crampons that had helped them cross the ice were now hindering them.
"We have to do something," Michael shouted. "We have to..."
"We have our own problems, Wabbit."
Following the dragon's gaze, Michael looked up past the town and saw a shape rising out of the citadel. His heart skipped a beat, then another shape rose up, and another.
"Oh no,"
Michael breathed. The three dragons wheeled about in the air, unleashed jets of flame, and dove directly at them. For a moment, seeing the ice spread across the harbor and watching the dwarves, elves, and humans race toward the city, seeing the distant flash of gold she knew was Wilhelmina, Kate had felt a spark of hope. But when she glanced at Rafe, he was smiling, and she took in the size of the army massing behind the walls, and then the three dragons rose up into the air, and Kate whirled on him, tears lashing her eyes, wild with fear and anger.
"Why did you bring me here? Just to watch all my friends die? To watch you murder them?"
In a flash, his hand was around her neck, and he was leaning forward, his voice a passionate hiss.
"I brought you here because I need you. Don't you see that? I need you to keep me human. I told you I know myself, and I do. Without you, I'm only the monster. I'm only that."
He swung his arm toward the battle, and Kate understood that it was not anger fueling him, but desperation.
"That's not the world I want. You believed I was still alive in your enemy. Believe in me now. All this will be over.
we'll be together.
You deserve to die.
The words sprang out of her, surprising both of them. His hand relaxed. Kate choked back sobs, but she kept her eyes fixed on his.
Henrietta Burke told me to love you. She said that would make all the difference, but she didn't have to tell me I already did love you. And I kept thinking all this time that Rafe was in there somewhere, that he'd come out if I just believed in him.
And now, what do you think? His voice was suddenly eerily cold.
I don't know if you're still Rafe or not, if he's in there or not, but you need to die.
He pulled her closer. She could feel his breath against her face.
And will you be the one to kill me, Kate? Can you?
Kate stared at him, wondering the same thing. Then, without warning, he cried out and fell to his knees. On instinct, Kate dropped beside him. He gasped.
How?
Unable to stop herself, Kate asked,
What is it? What happened?
She gave them back their memories.
What?
Your sister. I can't hold.
He let out another cry of pain, and then light began streaming out of him. Kate stumbled backward, blinking at the explosion of brightness, and the light rose up from him in a great rush, higher and higher, till it disappeared into the night. Kate stared in wonder. This was something Emma had done. She heard a crashing and looked out. A huge part of the city wall had collapsed, and it seemed to her that some power or force had gone out of the hordes of imps and screeches and trolls. They looked disorganized, lost. She glanced once more at Rafe, the light still streaming out of him, his eyes shut tight. Then she turned and ran. Emma was coming. Chapter 24 The Plunge. The prison was being dismantled, the cages smashed and tossed into the pit. A massive bonfire now raged there, throwing its flames high into the sky. For a while, pandemonium had reigned as the prisoners had clambered down the rickety scaffolding to the ground. Now the arena had mostly emptied out, and things were calmer. During the most chaotic moments, when the arena had been thronged by freed men, women, and children, Emma had clung to Gabriel's side, clutching his large, rough hand in her good one. How was it that he could be dead? He was so real and solid. While she held her other hand tight against her chest and above her heart to minimize the throbbing. The first thing Gabriel had done had been to bandage her wound, kneeling before her and wrapping a strip of cloth tightly around and around her hand. It had helped stem the bleeding, though dark red irises had appeared on both the front and back of the dressing. But Emma scarcely noticed the blood or felt the throbbing. Her attention, when she wasn't thinking about Gabriel and how she was going to save him, how she would correct the terrible mistake of his presence here, that's what it was, a mistake, had been drawn by the liberated throngs of the dead. Since her arrival in that world, she had grown almost used to the blank expressions, the dull emptiness of people's eyes, their listlessness and silence, perhaps the silence and hush most of all. And so it had been dizzying when 1,000 people had all started speaking at once, calling to one another, crying, shouting, laughing even. And that was just the beginning. Emma had watched a child reaching for a woman, and the woman lifting him in her arms. She'd watched 2 old men hugging each other and sobbing. She'd watched groups of people all talking at once, all trying to make sense of what had happened, all telling their stories. Everywhere she'd seen men and women, young and old, comforting each other with touches, with words. It had seemed, from what she could overhear, that they were like people waking from a long sleep. Again and again Emma heard, "It was like I was dreaming." To her surprise, no one railed against the fact of being dead, and it was not long before she heard people saying that they were going off to find their loved ones. They seemed to believe this was possible, that they and those they'd loved in life could somehow find each other in the vastness of the world of the dead. And perhaps they could. Perhaps they would be drawn together by some strange magnetism. Emma was aware that just days before she would have scoffed at the idea, but now, she thought, why not? Slowly the crowd had drifted out through the passages and avenues that had been created in the torn-down prison and vanished into the night. And the thing that Emma kept reminding herself of was that this was happening all over, that millions were waking up, an entire world. No, she corrected herself, not an entire world. A few figures stood idly about the arena, staring at the ground. All of them wearing the familiar vacant expressions of the dead. Of these, some had served the Dire Magnus, like the black-haired, rat-faced Necromantus, who stood at the edge of the pit, staring dully at the fire. He seemed to be almost daring Emma to go and push him in, but she wouldn't. She was better than that, though he deserved it, he really did. And there were guards as well, though obviously not Harold Barnes, who'd already gone off to find his nanny Marge, saying, "She'll be worried sick about me." The others, the former prisoners, whose memories had not been restored, Emma could not help but feel pity for. But it was what it was. She had made the judgment the book had required, and the judgment stood, and now the reckoning belonged to her. She held the book, tucked between her elbow and chest, as her hand throbbed with each beat of her heart. Dr. Pym had assured her that those who'd been sent into the fire, the ones the Dire Magnus had devoured, would already be returning to the world of the dead.
"Once their memories were restored," the wizard had said, "the Dire Magnus will not have been able to hold them. They will return here, and, thanks to you, most will remember who they are. I suspect he has released even those who did not have their memories returned. In the moment he will not have been able to pick and choose. You have dealt him a grave blow."
As evidence, he'd pointed to the red-robed sorcerers and former guards wandering about.
"Their master has deserted them. Now they have nothing. No memory of themselves, no connection to his power. They are lost."
Emma had merely nodded and said nothing. Even then her mind had already been moving on, thinking, planning, discarding everything that was not related to one goal, how she was going to save Gabriel. In those first minutes after his arrival, when the prisoners were escaping from their cages and she had found herself in Gabriel's arms and realized what his presence in this world must mean, she had been sobbing so furiously that she'd been unable to hear or see much of anything. He had held her and made reassuring noises, as one might to a small child, finally saying,
"I must bandage your wound."
By then, she'd gotten blood all over his neck and chest and arms, but he paid that no mind and knelt beside her, ripping a long strip from his cloak and wrapping it about her hand. Calmly, as if this were just another meeting between them, he'd begun to tell her about finding her parents, how he and Richard and Claire had gone searching for the prophecy as a means of saving her and her brother and sister. It had been loud in the arena, with the shouts of the freed prisoners and the crashing of the cages being destroyed, but Emma had heard every word he'd said, his voice anchoring her, as his love had anchored her during the bonding and her sobbing had subsided. She had even asked questions, some about their parents, how they'd looked, what they'd said, had they mentioned her, and some about Michael and Kate, which he couldn't answer, as he had not seen them since he'd sent them back to Loris. The one thing she didn't ask, and he didn't offer, was how he'd died. and all the time her mind was racing forward. Dr. Pym had moved off to one side, speaking to the old white-eyed sorcerer and one of the Caryadin. It might have been the one that had led Emma up the cliff earlier. She couldn't tell them apart. The other Caryadin, perhaps a dozen in all, was systematically destroying the prison, tearing it down level by level. Emma had asked the wizard what had led him and Gabriel to show up at the prison when they had, and Dr. Pym had replied that just as he'd felt compelled to guide Emma to the book, so he'd felt compelled to bring Gabriel here. He couldn't explain it further, besides to nod towards several of the Caryadin, saying,
"I suspect they had something to do with it. This is their world, after all."
Now Dr. Pym approached to say that it was time to go.
"We must return you to the world above, and the portal is some distance away."
"Uh-huh," Emma said, clutching Gabriel's hand more tightly than ever.
"I've been thinking. As soon as I kill the Diamagnus, I'll get Michael to use the Chronicle to bring Gabriel back. You too," she said to Dr. Pym, "though I'm not totally sure you still have a body. We'll have to, you know, work on that."
She nodded several times after she said this, as if to emphasize that Gabriel's returning to life was to be an accepted fact, and she failed utterly to notice the look that passed between Gabriel and the wizard. Then the old gray-haired, white-eyed sorcerer stepped forward, leaning heavily on his staff. He seemed more exhausted, somehow even older than before.
"I am sorry about your hand."
"Don't be. You had to do it."
"Still,"
and he touched lightly her wounded hand,
"forgive me, and thank you."
Emma hugged him once, fiercely, then let him go. The last thing that happened before they left that place was that one of the Caryadin landed near them, having half flown, half jumped from a cage above, and it was holding the Countess in its arms. The witch's face turned toward Emma and the others, and in an instant Emma saw that the woman's memories were gone.
"What happened to her?"
"When you bonded with the book," Dr. Pym said, "the last remnants of the magic were taken from her. The same thing happened to me when Michael became Keeper of the Chronicle. The Book of Life kept me alive for thousands of years, but after he became Keeper, even had I not been killed, I would have lived out whatever days were allowed me and then died."
The Countess's violet eyes were dull and dimmed, and Emma watched as the bird creature carried her from the arena. Emma felt a knife-edge of hatred for the Countess that would never go away. The witch had done too much to try and hurt her and her brother and sister, but in the end, the woman had helped her, and Emma would remember that too.
"Now," Dr. Pym said, "it's time."
Emma sensed movement behind her and felt rough hands under her arms. She was lifted off her feet, and her hand ripped from Gabriel's. In moments, she was high in the night sky, looking down at the prison and the bonfire below. She let out an involuntary, "Wah! Hey!" and looked up at the Caryadin holding her.
"Stop! What are you—"
She heard the voice in her mind.
"Be calm, Emma Wibberley. You are safe."
And she felt herself, in fact, becoming calm, and she peered down, the wind whipping past, and saw two more dark shapes, the great wings silhouetted against the bonfire, and she knew, without being able to make them out, that Gabriel and Dr. Pym were being carried upward as well. The Caryadin flew away from the prison and the shantytown and out across the dark, empty plain toward the mountains in the distance. The air was cold but clean, and after the smoke and reek of the prison, it came as a relief. Emma was reminded of flying on Wilhelmina's back when the elf princess had been in the form of a dragon. There was the same rise and fall with each beat of the creature's wings, the difference being that this time Emma's legs and feet dangled over nothingness and she was filled with equal parts excitement and terror. Soon the mountains were surging up out of the plain, and Emma was looking down at the thickly nestled peaks and saw, winding through them, the long, silvery band of a river. Then the Caryadin banked sharply, going into a steep, spiraling dive, and Emma clutched the Reckoning against her chest as the wind roared past and the jagged peaks rushed toward them. And they were coming in too fast. There was no way they could slow down in time, but at the last moment the Caryadin turned upward, suspending its momentum to hang in the air, then beat its wings twice to land and set Emma gently on the ground. Her heart was pounding wildly, and she stood there as if not quite trusting the earth beneath her feet. They were on a rocky outcropping beside the river, just before it plunged over a cliff. The roar of the waterfall filled the air, but Emma heard the thick, muscular rustle of feathers and turned to see the Caryadin launching itself back into the sky. She thought of shouting a thank you, but already the creature was gone into the night. Emma crept out as far as she could to where the river surged over the cliff and stood there, letting herself be soaked by the spray blowing back off the water, peering down to where the river disappeared into mist and darkness. The only other waterfall she knew was the one in Cambridge Falls, which she had thought enormous. She guessed that this one was at least twice that size, and doubted she could have seen to the bottom, even in the daytime. But why were they here? Where was the portal? She heard the rustle of wings, and she turned to see Gabriel landing sure-footed on the ledge, his Caryadin not even stopping, but continuing past, over her head and away. And even though Emma had only left Gabriel minutes before, she ran to him and hugged him, and he again folded her in his arms.
"It'll be okay," she said. "I'll make it okay."
Then she stepped away, wiping her eyes, as the wizard landed, the Caryadin who'd brought him also hardly stopping before climbing into the sky.
"Well," Dr. Pym said, smiling like his old self, "here we are."
"Here we are where?"
Emma demanded.
"Where's the portal?"
The last portal she had gone through had been a tunnel under a spider's nest. Obviously, there was nothing like that around here. Still, what the wizard said next surprised her.
"Over the waterfall, about halfway down."
"What? How am I supposed to get there?
You've got to call back those bird things."
"That